BitVM is a virtual computer. And if you're if you've ever dealt with virtual computers, you know, you download something like VirtualBox, you get the software for an operating system, you plug it in there and you hit go, and suddenly you've got like a digital version of a computer, you know, running a copy of Linux or Windows or Mac or whatever operating system you told it to, and it'll just pretend it's a Mac or pretend it's a Windows device. And that's what BitVM is. It's a virtual computer that we found a way to fit into Bitcoin.
Robin, Super Testnet, I just want to say welcome to Bitcoin Audible. It is really exciting to have you guys. I have been loosely diving into this project that you guys have been working on and listened to a bunch of stuff, but I was super stoked. Like, I really just wanted to have you guys on so that I could kind of dig through some of the edge cases and really just kind of get a direct response and kind of explore this with, I know the crew has been kind of buzzing about this as well, wanting to hear this episode. So I just want to say thank you guys so much for joining me on the show.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, hell yeah. Are you muted?
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
There we go. All right, guys. So I want to start with just what led you towards producing this. So the project, just in case anybody is unfamiliar at this point, is BitVM, which is a virtual machine, essentially arbitrary code that we can actually use to lock the ownership of Bitcoin on chain. So even though there's an extremely limited scripting ability on Bitcoin, quote unquote, limited programmability, we can actually trick it into not having that limitation. But I'm curious, and let's start with Robin and then we'll go to Super Testnet. Where did this come from? How did y'all kind of get to this point that y'all were trying to build this? And also, where did the idea come from? Like, what made you think you could even do this?
Okay, that's a lot of questions. Like, the high level goal is just to scale Bitcoin, right? To be able to process millions of transactions. And an idea that I find very appealing is to have a free market of sidechains, where essentially everybody can just spawn a new sidechain and be like, hey, I got this privacy feature, or I got this scalability feature, or whatever scripting capabilities. And I want to offer that to the market, and then the market can decide if that's useful or not. And that would be really awesome if that would exist. But that requires some kind of two-way pack, some kind of bridge. And this bridge is complicated, and people don't really agree on how these bridges should be built. And that's why it's so hard to convince the community to find a soft fork for building some kind of bridge. BIP300 is one proposal. People don't strongly agree on it, I would say, and that's why it doesn't happen currently. And
out of curiosity, were you a BIP300 proponent?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. What about you, Super Testnet? I don't think we've ever talked about it.
I think BIP300 is better than BitVM because it's just the clean way of doing it. BitVM suffers from the same problem at the end of the day. If really the majority of the hash power is evil, then yeah, the system fails pretty quickly. Same for BitVM as it is for drive chains. And drive chains is even more.
Yeah, I'm a fan of BIP300, and I wish we had it.
Now, out of curiosity, so, and this is something that I have had a really, really hard time getting clarification, or like really strict clarification on, you know, because one of the issues, like the golden ticket, so to speak, the magic bullet of a two-way peg is that no matter what, on the sidechain or whatever system we have for aggregating a bunch of transactions, the keys remain someone's ownership. Whereas the hash lock for BIP300, as I understand it, is that merely the majority hash rate is the ownership of the coins. Is that or is that not correct? Like, in the sense that the unlocking of the funds is purely due to 51% of the hash vote for that UTXO, for that balance of funds.
Yeah, but it's essentially the same here with BitVM, because if miners can censor the justice transaction, then there is no justice. So it's at the end of the day, it's the same thing. It's just
okay. So you're saying that even if the idea of censorship, being able to have 51% of the hash power or 70% of the hash power and censoring the ability to get your transaction through is essentially the same as being able to determine whether or not you own it or whether or not you can pull it out, because they can always put their the theft transaction. They can always include the theft transaction and just reorganize the justice transaction, the supposed official transaction, correct?
Yeah, okay. Every layer 2 protocol that relies on justice transactions suffers from the same protocol, from the same problem, that it can get censored by a malicious cartel of miners.
Gotcha. Okay, so this was always the goal. It was scaling. How do we get more? This would be interesting too, is if you could actually build BIP300 in BitVM, and then essentially use that to be the test case, you know, kind of like SegWit on Litecoin was. Is it okay if we can build it the messy way? Maybe it begins to make a lot more sense to build it the simpler way, or the more built-in way, right?
Yeah, definitely. And the cool thing about bridges is that it is kind of okay-ish if the bridge is messy, because even if just like a limited set of users can use that bridge, and even if it's very slow for them and it's cumbersome and maybe even expensive to use it, as long as it is reliable, then the packed coins, the sidechain coins, do have value. Then the value of the sidechain coins is actually redeemable for Bitcoin. And as long as that is the case, the coins make sense on the sidechain, and they do have a real value. And once they have a real value, you can just do atomic swaps. And most of the regular users will just do atomic swaps between main chain and side chain and will never use the bridge. And only very few users will actually use the bridge, which is cumbersome to use. But once we have that thing, we kind of don't have to use it anymore. And that's the good thing about it. Like that's the philosophy behind bridges, that even if they are cumbersome to use, you don't have to use them as when you can use them.
Yeah, it simply becomes an issue of liquidity.
I think there would be a significant downside of building a version of BIP300 into BitVM, or a copy, I should say, of BIP300 using BitVM. And the difficulty is that the whole idea behind BIP300 is to make it a consensus change, that Bitcoiners actually require that miners follow these new rules in their blocks. Otherwise, they won't consider them valid. Whereas BitVM is not that. BitVM is a non-consensus change. It doesn't require anyone to do anything in order for it to work. So if you just took the rules of BIP300 and put them in BitVM, and you said, like, you know, we're expecting miners to create blocks that have a certain, you know, a certain opera turn in the Coinbase, and they just don't do that, then BitVM is going to say this is an invalid block. And so you have to modify the rules of BIP300 in order to get it to work. And once you start doing that, you're down the path of saying, okay, we need something that's going to work more efficiently, given that this is a non-consensus change. And then you might as well just do something that fits that context better than trying to modify BIP300.
Gotcha. Okay. So out of curiosity, and I don't want to go too far on BIP300, but I've got two people who are proponents of it that I can ask questions, so I'm going to take the opportunity. In the context of validation, one of my problems with BIP300 in the context of, like, this is a wonderful solution to the problem, is that it doesn't really solve the scaling issue of validation in my thinking, is that if we're just having blockchains on top of blockchains and the miners are being relied upon or depended upon in order to do all of the relevant validation of all of these things. So I'll just use an example of just kind of, let's say we have tons of these different side chains and we're doing this a lot, right? Like, this becomes the standard. So we've got 100 different BIP300 side chains and they're all various versions of blockchains with their own little script or whatever. And we want to think of these things as secure, or we want to think of these things as pegged to going back and forth from Bitcoin. Now, obviously, they only have to validate the main chain. But if we're expecting these things to be secure, then we would want the miners to be validating all of the data on every one of these chains. And let's say 5%, 10% of the miners are only ever worried about 1, 2, maybe 3 of these side chains, and they're just kind of blind. I mean, blind merge mining, right? They're just kind of blind mining the rest of them. Is how does this really change the dynamic of needing an enormous amount of validation? Because, like, maybe you still need, quote unquote, 51% of the miners, but if 51% of the miners aren't even bothering to check or don't have the capacity to check all of this data from all of these different side chains, what's the nuance there? What am I missing about the difference in the data load, the validation load, for those miners to actually think of those as different than just like having 100 gigabyte block size?
Well, in the crypto world, there are very few problems that you cannot solve with zero knowledge proofs. And if you could just have chain state proofs of each of the side chains, then it would be trivial to verify the state of all of them, even on a phone.
I personally wouldn't want to use a drive chain, even if it was mined by 100% of miners, because I don't want to put my money in the control of a bunch of Bitcoin miners. However, I want it to be an option. I want people to have the option to say, oh, look, X number of miners are mining this chain. Do I trust it? Is that good enough for me? And then everyone can make their own decision. I like people to have options. So I'm not of the mind that I want miners to be validating every chain, that every drive chain, if we get them. That doesn't concern me at all. I want miners to do whatever they want. And then users, if they want to use a drive chain, they can look at it and say, oh, look, only 5 miners are actually doing anything with this thing. I'm not going to use that one.
Gotcha.
Or whatever. Gotcha.
So in your mind, it's just, and see, this is, in my opinion, the best. It's always been the perspective that it's been difficult for me to just completely negate, was that, is it bad just as having it as an option? My one pushback against that is that, like, okay, well, a soft fork to just have an option that I'm not even sure about is a lot. And especially if it's contentious, it seems unlikely that it's going to happen. But I value that argument. I think that's a solid perspective to take, in my opinion. And then Robin, your point is just that, well, if you're not restricted in what sort of code you can run on the drive chain, well, then maybe it's just not a blockchain. Maybe it's just a completely different sort of setup where you can actually validate it. And with, you know, like you said, on a phone with zero knowledge proofs or whatever it is. So just having that scope of programming.
Yeah, with validity proofs, you can turn it into a data availability problem. So it's essentially just downloading the data, right? That is the main problem long term. Validity proofs will become so incredibly efficient. What we're currently seeing is this Cambrian explosion of proof systems. And within the next 5 to 10 years, this problem will be so solved. Like, it will be standard for new blockchains to be just proven from the beginning on, such that you have state proofs for every state. And that will be the future.
Interesting.
Most likely, I would say. And then you can run thousands of these sidechains and validate them instantly. The problem is just downloading the data to also solve the data availability problem. But validating the data is instant in the future, I would say.
This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck wallet on mobile that just connects directly to or just talks NFC whenever I need a sign. The Nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my cold card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my Nunchuck wallet and I tap it to my cold card. I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products, like the block clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a cold card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out. Okay, switch this over to BitVM. How is BitVM related to this? How did you construct it? Like, what is Bit? Maybe that's the easiest way to do this. But what is BitVM for the audience?
Yeah. BitVM is a programming paradigm to express more complex Bitcoin scripts. Well, more complex Bitcoin contracts. That is like the abstract way to put it. And the more concrete way to put it is, it's a way to enable stuff like bridges, stuff like BIP300 on Bitcoin without any kind of soft fork, without any consensus change.
The way that I would put it is that BitVM is a virtual computer. And if you've ever dealt with virtual computers, you download something like VirtualBox, you get the software for an operating system, you plug it in there and you hit go, and suddenly you've got like a digital version of a computer, running a copy of Linux or Windows or Mac or whatever operating system you told it to, and it'll just pretend it's a Mac or pretend it's a Windows device. And that's what BitVM is. It's a virtual computer that we found a way to fit into Bitcoin and make it compatible with Bitcoin. And inside of this virtual computer, you can do what you can do on other computers. You can run programs. But the unique thing is that these programs are compatible with Bitcoin. Like if the program says, you won at Doom, for example, Bitcoin can understand that and it can reward someone for, winning at Doom. You can be like, okay, I'm going to lock up this money so that you have to win at Doom in order to unlock it. But because it's a computer, you can run any program. You can run a copy of Bitcoin. You can run a copy of Ethereum. You can say stuff like, you only get this money if, Ethereum says you're supposed to, or if Liquid says you're supposed to, or if this version of Bitcoin with an extra soft fork added in, an extra opcode, if that says you're supposed to. Whatever software you want, you can run in this virtual machine. And that's what I think is really cool about it.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that. You could run a whole other version of Bitcoin with an opcode that Bitcoin doesn't have. Oh, that's interesting. That's so crazy to think about. So how the hell how'd you manage this? How does this work?
I would say, like, on the low level, one of the most important ideas is this idea of a bit commitment, which allows you to have state that persists across different UTXOs. That was a thing that was more or less intentionally not allowed in Bitcoin script. And this idea of bit commitments, they reintroduced that. Well, it has never been introduced, so reintroduced is the wrong word. But they enable state across multiple scripts. And then you can do stateful contracts. You can do like these challenge response games where you make a claim and then I verify if that claim is correct. I verify that off-chain on my computer. And if it's incorrect, then we can make a challenge response game where I ask you questions and you give responses. Or like if you stop giving responses, you lose. And I try to ask clever questions to make you contradict yourself. And as soon as you contradict yourself, then I can punish you in a bond contract. And this way I can ensure that you will not make a claim that is incorrect. And this challenge response protocol becomes possible by this state that is introduced with this bid commitments. And it's essentially a very simple idea because a bid commitment is just two hash locks and you can reveal one of them. And if you reveal pre-image 0, then you set the value to 0. And if you reveal pre-image 1, then you set the value to 1. But if you contradict yourself and reveal pre-image 0 at this point, and then at the next point you reveal pre-image 1, then I have both pre-images and I can use them in another leaf of the tap tree to punish you. Because if I know both pre-images, that means you contradicted yourself. You set the state to 0 and then you set the state to 1. And that is illegal. You always have to be consistent. You always have to say you set it to 0, so you will always use 0. Yeah, and once you contradict yourself, that is a proof, that is a fraud proof, and that can be used to end the game.
Okay. So here, I'm actually curious, Super Testnet, what would be your explanation before I start kind of picking at some of these pieces? I'm curious.
Good idea.
I'm curious to hear your analysis of this too.
Of how we made BitVM work.
Yes. How'd you make it work?
Yeah. So Robin talked a little bit about the hash commitments, which is definitely an important part of it. And I think another thing that's that goes into it is this idea of logic gates. Every computer chip, if you took the computer chip out of your computer and looked at it under a microscope, you would see that it's composed of millions of these very tiny structures called logic gates. And mm-hmm. these control the flow of electricity that comes from your battery and goes back to the negatively charged part of your battery. The electricity is just going from one part of your battery to the other, but it's passing through a circuit. And that circuit makes the electricity do tricks. Like you're going to put electricity through two wires, and your computer is only going to send along the signal if both of those wires have electricity in them. Or maybe, depending on what program you're running, maybe it'll do it only if one of them has electricity flowing through it. These things are called logic gates, and your computer combines them into very intricate patterns in order to control the flow of electricity through the pixels on your laptop screen and make it show an image of a cat or something because it said, only turn on these pixels because that's what the logic gates say to do. Mm-hmm. But what we do with BitVM is we take a regular computer program and we deconstruct it down into all of the logic gates that program would have to pass through if it was running on an actual computer. Mm-hmm. Because that's what it's all ended up doing. It's all a little circuit running on a circuit board inside your microchip. And so we just copy that, what the program will end up being, which is just a series of logic gates that electricity is passing through. And we put all of that into a Bitcoin address, which Taproot lets us do. Taproot lets us have many, many scripts, many, many logic gates that are all part of one Bitcoin address. And so we take a whole big program like Photoshop or something, or even an operating system like Linux. We decompose it into the logic gates that it will run through if it was run on an actual physical computer. And we put a copy of each of those logic gates on Bitcoin. And we can do that because Bitcoin script, the scripting language that Bitcoin uses, has all of the logic gates in it. So that's what we do. And then once we have a copy of the program in Bitcoin, we can both run it off-chain. We can both run Photoshop, for example, off-chain and see what the program says, happens at the end. Like he drew a drew a picture of a cat or whatever. And then if we disagree on the, or if we agree on the outcome, we can say, okay, you drew me the picture of the cat that I wanted to pay for, so I'll just send you the money. But if we disagree, we can go to Bitcoin and we can run the program on Bitcoin, or at least the part of it where we disagree. And Bitcoin can say, yeah, that he said, you know, this logic gate produces a one, but it actually produced a zero. So I'm going to give the money to this other guy instead. And that's really, I think, the other aspect of this. It's like, it's the hash locks that Robin talked about, as well as the logic gates that really make this thing work.
Gotcha. Okay. So let me start breaking out some of these pieces.
There's a third thing here. And the third thing is the idea that it's fundamentally easier to disprove an incorrect execution than to execute it yourself. It's
okay.
Much easier to say that this answer is incorrect than to compute the correct answer. And that's what BitVM is based on, because one party just makes a claim and they claim this is the result, and both parties compute the correct result off-chain, and if that claimed result is incorrect, then the other party disproves that result. But it's never really computed on-chain. It's just disproven if it's incorrect. And disproving an incorrect result is much easier than, For example, For example, if I would say to you, multiply for me 123 with 456 or whatever, and then you say to me, yeah, the answer is 13. And then I can say, well, no, that cannot be true, because the number of digits is not enough. It must be, about 6 digits or something. Yeah? And you just gave me 2 digits. And then I can know, without computing it, I can prove that this answer has to be incorrect. So disproving your answer is much easier here than computing it myself. And the cool thing is, once you have that claim, once you can nail down to a particular claim, you can attack it from all ways how it could be incorrect. And then you just choose the most efficient way to attack it to disprove that result. And that is vastly more efficient than actually executing the entire code on chain. We never execute anything on chain except for the incorrect stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah, another example I think is might be useful for illustrating that is, let's suppose that you and I wanted to run a program, an addition program, and I wanted to say what's 13 plus 6, and so I run that through my copy of the VM and I get 19, and then I go to you and I say, okay, I got 19. What did you get? If you tell me 5 or something, I know you did something wrong. I know you ran the code improperly. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have to run the entire program on Bitcoin. I don't know. Maybe the computer, the virtual machine, had to do like 30 logical operations to add the number 6 to 13. But I don't have to run all of them. I can just look at where we agreed or the first place where we disagreed, rather. I can say, okay, well, the first 6 steps of this 30-step procedure, we got the same results. But on step 7, I got a 1 and you got a 0 from this, from this logical operation. So that's the one I'm going to challenge. There's no need to challenge the ones we agree on. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to even challenge all of the ones we disagree on. We just need to find one. And if we find one where you were dishonest, then I should get the money.
Gotcha.
Naturally. So we don't actually have to run the full program on Bitcoin. We just have to find one area where we disagree and run that little step, a tiny little step, one little logic gate. And that's all we do on Bitcoin.
Interesting. So you abstract it away into a script tree with Taproot, because that's the beauty of Taproot, right? Is that you can have as essentially an unbounded script tree to an extent, such that you can just keep hashing it up the tree. And then at the end of the day, all you have to actually post is the final signature. And so what we're doing with the code of, let's say, a program that's doing addition, a calculator, something like that, is we're breaking it down into chunks, and then at the end of each chunk that where we're executing some piece of it, let's say we, like you said, we broke it down into 7 different chunks, it's a process, and we go from step 1 to step 7, and with each one of those things we just basically have a final signature that at each one of those steps, and if someone produces the incorrect result, then all they have to do is go from, you know, 6 to 7 or whatever to just produce the fact that I came up with a different answer, like that you made a mistake. And then that's the only part of it that actually needs to be published. Am I grabbing that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So you, SuperTestNet, you mentioned being able to run Linux in this. Now, what are the limitations of the actual computation? Because as I understand it, it's an abstraction of a logic gate, not an obviously not an actual logic gate. So what you're actually doing is a whole lot of, you know, computational process in order to recreate the result of a logic gate, but it's way, way more computation than if you're actually running it on just a tiny little circuit that's just, you know, on, off, on, off, on, off. So what's the relative comparison in the computation, and is it actually feasible with the amount of size that you would have to have this script to literally run a full Linux operating system that determined the ownership of a UTXO, of an amount of Bitcoin?
So a couple of things. You're right. We're not using actual logic gates, because actual logic gates are computer circuitry. They control the actual flow of electrons.
Sure.
We're running a simulation. So instead of actual electrons, we use zeros and ones. A one represents an electron flowing. A zero says it's not. So we're just simulating those. However, your computer is taking our simulation and it's running it. And ultimately, after several layers of abstraction, it actually is passing through the real logic gates when it gets down to the circuit level. It's just that it passes through several programming languages first before it gets there, and compilers and interpreters and stuff like that. So it introduces a lot. You know, probably I don't know how efficient computers are these days, but I would not be surprised if it's something like a factor of 1,000 more times processing than it would if it was running on an actual circuit instead of a simulated circuit, which is then, you know, processed through interpreters and compilers and finally gets down to a real circuit. So it's much more complex. And as to what it would take to run an actual Linux operating system, people have definitely done this. There are simulated versions of Linux running on logic gate circuits that are, you know, created in JavaScript. People have done it, and it works. So I've never done it, and that's one of the things I'm trying to learn. It's like how to make that happen so we can actually do this on Bitcoin. I'm not a good person to ask right now as to what it takes. I've seen other people do it, and I'm trying to learn what their techniques are.
Okay, interesting. That's so crazy.
I can give a more concrete answer. So in the paper, I described everything with these NAND gates. And I did that because NAND gates are universal gates, and that means you can express any function in a NAND gate if you wanted to. However, I tried to emphasize that this is not very efficient in practice. And also, if every user would have to start crafting every program into some kind of NAND gate circuit, that would become very cumbersome and probably also very expensive or like error prone. It's not the way you usually express any kind of smart contracts or so. Usually you want to have like some high level language that is very safe and that just rules out a lot of errors that could happen just by the language design in the first place. Long story short, it's not a cool idea for everyone to implement low-level circuits. It's a much cooler idea to say, well, let's just implement a single circuit that is capable of disproving an incorrect state transition of a virtual machine. And then we get like all the good stuff. We can have essentially a virtual machine that has infinite memories, like seriously like gigabytes of memories, and it could have essentially all instructions that we know. You would probably not do that. You would probably reduce it to something like a simple RISC-V instruction set or something. And once you have that, you can just run stepwise instructions, and after each step you can merkleize the entire memory. And like including the registers and like the entire state of the machine is merkleized into a single root. And then you can just make claims about the state of the machine. And that is as good as claiming the result of an outcome of some computation. And this way the machine can run like for a billion cycles or something. And then I just ask you, what do you think is the end result? And then you make a claim and you give me the root hash of the state that you believe is the right state. And then there are two cases. Either you gave me the correct state or you gave me the incorrect state. And then I can just start doing a binary search. Like I ask you, well, if that was the 1 billion state, which state is like 500 million? And from there, I can half and half and half and half until I found the first state transition that we disagree on. And with like 30 queries or something, I can find the first state transition in a billion state transitions that we disagree on. And that would be totally feasible on chain. It would require 30 transactions, which is not nice. Yeah, if you have to execute 30 transactions.
Yeah.
But that gives you a billion state transitions on a generic processor, right? With arbitrary amounts of memory. And that is quite significant, I would say. Like that gives us pretty big off-chain computing capabilities.
So I'd like to mention I probably did a disservice to the BitVM community by building an implementation on launch day that did everything wrong, did everything the wrong way. And I did that because I was one of the first people Robin told about this idea. I thought it was so cool. And it was similar to some things I'd done in the past with logical circuits. So I was able to quickly get a few example functions that could actually run in this paradigm, like an addition function and a string checking function and a couple of other things. And so I like made a demo, and on the same day he launched the white paper, I showed everyone, look, I got it working. I got some code. And then a lot of people took a look at my code, which you should never do, because I'm notorious in this space for doing everything in the worst possible way. And I'm actually doing it in logical circuits. I'm composing each function into these logical circuits that take 30 or 60 or 150 steps to do a simple operation. And it proves the concept. It proves you can do this. But it does everything in the exact way that Robin's paper says this would be a terribly inefficient and stupid way to do this. But everyone's looking at my code and they're saying, wow, it works. You can do this in BitVM. And we've got a whole Telegram community of people trying to learn how to do logical circuits. And they shouldn't be. It's a stupid way to do this. It's just there. I should be more clear. It's just there to prove the concept. Yeah. It's not intended to be the thing we're going to actually run.
Gotcha. This episode is brought to you by the Fold Card. This is the debit card that gets you sats back on literally everything in your life. I actually got some Boost back today on Starbucks, and they have a ton of these now for specific merchants like Who. This is HU. This is actually a company that I've been a big fan of for a long time. I think it was like 2.5 or 3% back if I spend at Who online. They make like super clean chocolates and like little cookies and stuff that are all grain-free, keto-friendly, and they're absolutely delicious. I had no idea until I was just looking through the Boost that they had added that on. I was like, oh my God, I am so excited. And of course, we also got our Whole Foods today. We got our groceries, and because Whole Foods takes Amazon gift cards, we got 2.5% back on our groceries. And that's literally just the gift cards and the Boosts. The card, the debit card, which is my main card, I swipe it and I get sats. I just get sats all the time. And I get spins so that I can win free sats also. I get daily spins, which on the spin wheel, you can literally win up to a full Bitcoin. Like, people have genuinely won an entire Bitcoin, 100 million sats, just from the spin wheel, just from using the Fold card. And understand, I have used this to replace a boring, crappy, I hate to deal with it, normal fiat bank. This has replaced that, and now it pays me sats all the time. I've gotten a quarter of a Bitcoin. Again, I did not pay. I did not buy. I did not, like, stack ongoing with, like, a pre-purchase plan a quarter of a Bitcoin. I got a quarter of a Bitcoin back with all of the purchases that I normally make in fiat by getting 1%, 2%, 3% back on just normal things that I do. So I've spend $100, I get like $2 in Bitcoin. This is unbeatable when it comes to a low barrier way to stack enormous amounts of sats over time. Check them out. Go to bitcoinaudible.com/fold. That is my special link that will also give you like 100,000 free sats just for checking it out, just for trying it. Again, bitcoinaudible.com/fold. It's right there in the show notes, so it'll be really easy to find. Check it out.
Okay. And back to a point that Robin, an explanation that Robin gave is, so what we're actually doing is we're separating out the program and we're Merkleizing, we're making it into a Merkle tree. And then basically, as we section this off, we break that down and then we use each one of those individual like sections. Let's say it's like 100,000 steps or something. And then you take each one of those Merkle tree roots and you use that into the tap root and you do another Merkle tree of the signatures in the tap tree. So you're kind of doing this at two different layers until you get back to the fact that you only need those seven challenges or whatever it is on Bitcoin in order to ultimately prove that the entire thing executed correctly. Is that
incorrect?
Accurate?
Is you that never a, execute something or incorrectly?
Excuse me. Excuse me. Yes, you're proving the wrong, not the correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Man, this is crazy. Okay. And one of the things that you've specifically talked about and is in the white paper as well is that this is a one-to-one relationship, right? So you've got a prover and is it a prover and a verifier? No, what?
Yes.
Those are the terms? Okay, yep. Prover and a verifier. So this is, so much like a Lightning channel, this mm-hmm. is a two of two multisig. And it's largely got a very similar enforcement contract as Lightning as well, as I understand it, is mm-hmm. that, you know, like you have multiple branches and if everything goes right, you don't have to worry about any of it. You don't have to post anything. You just have a dual signature and everything goes. If something goes wrong, then you do the justice transaction or the payout. The other part is not their payout route, correct? So it's kind of like a Lightning contract.
Very similar, yes.
Very similar, okay.
Yeah, that's some of the things it has in common with Lightning. You've got two parties. We call them Paul and Vicky in BitVM, whereas they're Alice and Bob in Lightning. But we got Paul and Vicky. They both create a multisig address. They both put some money into it. They do a bunch of stuff off-chain. On Lightning, it's a bunch of transactions. On BitVM, it's a bunch of computation. And then they put the result of the final state. In Lightning, they put the result of the final state on Lightning where they have on the blockchain where they just have a justice transaction where there was some sort of dispute and they go to Bitcoin to adjudicate. In BitVM, when you have a closure, typically Vicky sends some money to Paul and that's the end of it. She paid him for some computation. But if there's a dispute, then you go to Bitcoin and say, adjudicate this dispute. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar to Lightning. It uses a lot of the same paradigms. But instead of doing transactions off-chain, you're doing computations.
Is it possible, do you think, to put this within an HTLC rather than within the channel itself, such that you could do the challenge response as Lightning payments rather than on-chain payments? Can you obscure it one more layer?
Well, you could. You can create them inside of HTLCs. But the difficulty is if you're having a dispute, mm-hmm. There's nothing to stop your counterparty from closing out that HTLC and putting it on chain. If he is disputing with you, he probably wants to ruin your day. Mm-hmm. He probably wants it to take a long time and be as expensive as possible. Yeah. And so doing it in an HTLC would just add another transaction that costs you money for him to ruin your day.
I see, because you're not saving it because it's specifically a conflict. You still just have additional, every challenge HTLC is still something that has to go to chain. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got you.
If he was being cooperative, if he was being nice,
then sure,
like, oh,
you don't
I'm
need
to make you go to chain for this.
Yeah. Okay. I see what you mean.
You just not have to do a dispute at all.
Yeah.
You don't need the BitVM if you don't have a dispute.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we talked about commitments. Like this is built into like each run of the software is being committed to with a signature or a hash that is locking that payment, or that is locking that amount. And as I understand it, this could also be, I don't see that that must be possible that you could actually have some sort of other system that's illustrating or that is controlling relative balances so that you could update balances on this thing with this program. And then again, you could challenge the incorrect balance. So I guess the question would be, do you know how yet? Do you have a conception of how to actually make this a one party as a prover and 100 parties as a verifier without, I mean, obviously you could do it with a 100 person multisig, but that requires an enormous amount of interaction, right? And how does this conceptually work multi-party? That's, do you have that sorted out? How are you thinking about that problem? Maybe that's just the easier thing to tackle.
Yeah, as you said, like it requires definitely some setup. Like if you have 100 people, then you essentially have to do a lot of pre-signing with 100 of 100 people. And the good thing is that it's just one round, or like it's only two rounds. Like the dealer proposes a circuit, then it sends it to each of the 100 people, and then they sign. Like first they verify, then they sign, and then they send it back, and then everything is fine. It's not quadratic computation. It's not quadratic communication. It's each verifier has to do it only once in the beginning, and it is some work, but it's not impossible, I would say. It doesn't scale very well to like 100,000 or so. Maybe it would even scale to 1,000. That shouldn't be impossible, I would say. Of course, like if you need 1,000 people to agree, then if only a single person disagrees, like if they refuse to sign or if they go offline or whatever, then it all fails and you have to restart. But I think it's still possible. Like you can try it like for an hour, and then you will find some combination of people that are actually online, and all the other people that refuse to sign, you can exclude them in the next round, and you will somehow agree. You will come to an end, and it's just a matter of like how long does it take to set up the circuit initially? Is it like a matter of seconds, or is it a matter of a day? Is it a matter of a week? I would say it would be definitely possible to do it with 1,000 people.
Interesting. Super Tesnet, do you have anything to add on that topic?
I just like to be a little pedantic and mention that it's always multi-party because there's always two people. There's always Paul and Vicky.
Okay.
So
I appreciate that. I appreciate that correction. This is still just, I'm still, my picture is getting clearer, but it's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around. What is possible with this is broad enough. Maybe I'll take this with another question actually. So CTV is built in simplified commitments into the Bitcoin code. How would this change, make better, or would it improve, not have any effect at all, the construction of these things and the ability to kind of the interaction needed for setting this up with a lot of parties? Again, use the example of 1,000 people. How does CTV potentially play into this?
I think it could be non-interactive with covenants in general. Such that,
what do you mean by that?
Set it up once.
Set it up once.
As I just explained, in the multi-party setting, you have the problem mm-hmm. that every verifier has to pre-sign a lot of things for all the other verifiers. And that limits how many verifiers there can be in practice. And if you had covenants or like CTV, then also like cat would be the same, or TX hash or so. Like there are many proposals that would enable the same thing. That would allow that dealer to just construct the transactions, and then they would just send them to the verifiers, and they would not have to sign them. They would just check them that they are correct, and then they would know, okay, this works. And that would mean we could have way more verifiers. We could potentially have like everybody being a verifier, like everybody who has a Bitcoin UTXO. You know, you could essentially like pre-sign, or like not sign, you can just pre-construct a circuit for everybody who is in the Bitcoin UTXO set. And that would be essentially trustless then, right? Because then, the setup cost becomes so cheap that basically everybody can become a verifier. And then it's essentially trustless, because the trust assumption is that there is at least one honest verifier. And if there can be a million verifiers, then there is probably one honest verifier, or you can be the one honest verifier easily.
Yeah.
So one of the things I'd like to point out here is that the concept of rollups. So the Ethereum ecosystem has been experimenting with these types of sidechains called rollups for a couple of years now. And one of the characteristics of a rollup sidechain is that they have a set of at least one or more provers and a set of one or more verifiers who need to verify the statements of the prover. The prover says something like, here's the current state of the sidechain, and here's all the people who pegged out of the sidechain in this block, and here's my proof that I paid them, however much they pegged out. And at least one person in the set of verifiers has to be trusted to check that all that information is correct, or invalidate it by proving that there's something he did incorrectly. But Ethereum often says, it can be you. Like, you don't have to trust any particular person. You can be the one to check the prover's work and verify that this stuff is accurate. Mm-hmm. And the same thing applies here. If we make rollups, they come with the characteristics of rollups. If we were able to figure out a way to prove statements in zero knowledge using BitVM, then we can probably create rollups, but then we have to have a set of verifiers, and the same thing applies. You either have to trust somebody to validate whatever the prover is saying about the state of the sidechain, or you have to be one of the verifiers and prove those statements. And that requires some degree of setup and running some software in order to do that.
Gotcha. Okay, so, and Robin, you're with ZeroSync, and so you've been... I mean, is this a large part of why you even tackled this task? Have you been trying to figure out how to do rollups and zero knowledge proofs and stuff on Bitcoin? Is this a large part of the problem?
Yeah, like the general idea behind ZeroSync is that these zero knowledge proof systems, validity proofs, they are really groundbreaking cryptography. And I think that they are probably the future of Bitcoin. And that is because, the compression capabilities of these things, they are so enormous. You can compress, for example, the entire blockchain, which is 600 gigabytes, you can compress it into a proof that is just a single megabyte. And that is just so groundbreaking that it will probably have a huge impact on Bitcoin in general. And ZeroSync is essentially born out of the excitement of this, the excitement about this technology, and we wanted to apply zero knowledge proofs to Bitcoin, and like the most straightforward way to do that was to build a validity proof of Bitcoin to do what I just said, like building a chain state proof of Bitcoin, and that was how ZeroSync started. However, the idea was not just to build the chain state proof, but to, in general, research and explore ways to apply zero knowledge proofs to Bitcoin. And of course, the end goal was always to have some kind of zero knowledge proof verifier on the main layer, because once we have that, we can scale Bitcoin vastly better, probably. And that's why we also explored different ways to think about like opcodes, opckp verify. And yeah, of course, we all know it's hard to change Bitcoin and to introduce consensus changes, and in particular with such new technologies as zero knowledge proofs, where like there is no off-the-shelf implementation where everybody would agree, this is totally secure and we have been using that for 40 years, so straightforward. That just doesn't exist in that field. Like everything is super new, and it would be very hard to come to a consensus to activate some zero knowledge proof verifier. The most likely way is probably simplicity, but still, even simplicity would take forever, probably like 5 years or so before it would be active on mainnet. So yeah. It became apparent that it would be kind of cool to hack around this limitation, to find some way to hack a ZKP verifier into Bitcoin with the existing limitations. And Super Testnet and Sam Parker and I, we started a Telegram group where we invited a couple of cool Bitcoiners and started exploring hacks, what we can do with Bitcoin script, what is possible, what is impossible, what are the limitations, and how to hack around them. And yeah, after exploring that for about half a year, the idea of BitVM was born. So to wrap it up in short terms, BitVM, the main idea of BitVM was actually to verify zero knowledge proofs on Bitcoin to increase scalability and to enable stuff like ZK rollups.
Is that going to be the first? Is that the first thing you're trying to build with it? Are y'all trying to build something smaller and you know more direct, or are y'all going straight for zero knowledge proofs? What's kind of a timeline on getting something actionable, like tested, for running one of these things?
I would say it's really like what I'm working on is to finish a toy version of that actual BitVM, which means like mm-hmm. it's a virtual machine that you can program and that you can hopefully use as a compile target for like LLVM or like Clang or something like that, so that you can compile high level languages down to BitVM, for example, from C or like Rust or something. And once you can do that, once you can compile Rust down to the BitVM, then you can use all the available proof systems, because most of them are written in Rust. So then we can use Starks and Plonky 2 and like all the good things that are out there. And we can start experimenting with them. That would be the timeline. And I think it's particularly important to like build this VM instead of building like lots of different circuits, because once we have that VM, we can really have that as a foundation to build a builder culture on top of that, and have people explore what's possible and what are cool use cases for it and explore it in a cheap way.
And I'd like to mention that I know that the way I'm doing it with my little proof of concept is inefficient. And I know that even the white paper says it would be very stupid to build BitVM this way. But I had a whole lot of fun building it and making it. Mm-hmm. And me and the other guys in our Telegram group were having a lot of fun writing circuits for it and learning how to write logic gate circuits. So if that sounds fun to you, I know it's inefficient and stupid, but that doesn't mean you can't do it. Come on to our Telegram group, or even go to my GitHub and actually try it out, because I've got a working thing that you can actually run these things on Bitcoin. You can go to my GitHub. It's my most starred repository, and check out the three functions that currently work. Learn how to write them yourself, and then come to our Telegram group to share what you've built. And a lot of people are having fun doing that, so I invite you to do that, even though it's not... it's not the smart way that Robin's trying to do. It's the fun way that Super Testnet's trying to do. So come check it out.
Telegram group. Do you have the link to that posted somewhere, or you want to just send it to me? Because I'd love to at least just go hang out and keep up with what's going on and try to be exposed to it a lot.
I'll share the link to my implementation, as well as the Telegram group where we're hacking away at it.
All right. I will have those in the show notes. Implementation.
You can also check out github.com/bitvm.
Github.com.
Yeah, that's the smart version.
Gotcha, the smart version. I hear you. So what's kind of next for this? Like what's been the level of like response and excitement about this? Are y'all trying to get funding to like just really kind of go hard and be able to commit, like fully commit to this? Like kind of what's in the plan for where you're going with it?
Yeah, it would be really awesome if we get funding for it to make it a real thing. What we are doing mm-hmm. right now is we are building a toy version to like show how it should all fit together and like have a way to play around with it and easily modify it and stuff like that. And once data has proven to work out and like once that also like convinced people that it actually works, then it would be really cool to do some fundraising to like scale it and turn it into a real product and like to build a version in Rust that is like hardened code and that is production ready. That would be so awesome.
And I'd just like to mention that I personally have no official connection with the BitVM project.
Okay.
I happened to be to hear about it like pre-release, and I thought it was really cool. So I'm not connected in any way at all, other than I think it's cool, and I was able to build a proof of concept really quickly. So yeah, be aware of that.
Okay, gotcha.
This episode is brought to you by Nodeless.io. This is the way to get your friends who are pre-coiners, who are like kind of interested and want to be able to accept Bitcoin, but just don't want the headache. They don't want the setup issues and trying to figure out how to run a Lightning node. They just want to be able to plug in an address and then have all of the web front end that they need for a charity, for their project, for their WooCommerce store, their online sales, all of these different things. And then just no obligation, no subscription, no KYC, just receive payment and it goes directly to their address, to their cold card, to their hardware wallet, whatever it is. This is why Nodeless exists, to lower that barrier as much as possible, to make it as easy as it can be to set this up and for people to join the Bitcoin economy. Listen, as someone who runs a node and who has BTC Pay server and loves tinkering with a lot of these things, I am using Nodeless because it's just that easy. And that's also why I'm offering 10,000 free sats to anyone who goes, just sign up with email, whatever you want to do, really quick sign up, again, no subscription, no obligation, no KYC, just create an account, go to the create a donation page, make a donation page, and I will be your first donation. I will share it on Noster, share it on Twitter, and just tag me in it so that I see it in my notifications, and I will go there and I will throw you 10,000 sats. Then stay there, look around, check out the project. I think this is a really, really cool, it's still new, and I just think there's a massive amount of potential here, and I think a lot of you guys can benefit from it. So that's why I'm willing to throw you 10,000 sats just to go check it out. Use my link specifically, by the way, that helps, just so that they know that I sent you over there. You can find that in the show notes or just go to bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless. Again, that is bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless.
If we have a soft fork and you have the option of some opcode, you know, sighash all CTV, maybe a zero knowledge proof, like right into a Bitcoin opcode, what would kind of be the best opcode that you think would actually be maybe reasonable to get implemented that would make this, you know, an order of magnitude better or more efficient or easier to implement?
Yeah, opcat would be really awesome. Like if I put everything together from like how powerful it is and how likely it is that it becomes a thing and how like simple it is, so that it's definitely possible to find consensus on it. I would absolutely say opcat is the most impactful potential soft fork that is currently in discussion. Of course, if we had like an opcKP verify, that would be even more awesome because we could use it for essentially everything. But I think it's very unrealistic that we get any kind of ZKP verifier on the main layer within the next 5 years or so as an opcode. Like, I definitely see how we can hack around it, but we won't get like a particular opcode for it.
I don't know if you've come up with a name for your implementation of the VM, but when you get to that, I hope you name it after a big cat, like a cougar or a leopard or something.
Yeah, Lion VM or something.
Yeah.
King of the Bitcoin jungle. So with
This is, I think, the best proposal out there, and it would be really, really awesome if we would activate OpCat, and I totally cheer for Ethan and Andrew, who are championing it on the mailing list.
So OpCat, as I understand it, is a way to, it's actually similar to what is enabled with CTV, because you're able to essentially concatenate the entire transaction so that like pieces of the transaction can be committed to, right? So that you could have an individual balance within a transaction. Like the prime example being that, like, if you have one Bitcoin at one UTXO, well, you could concatenate out that and commit to the fact that, well, I own 0.1 of that, Robin owns 0.3 of that, and Testnet owns the other 0.6. As I understand that correct?
Yeah. That is called introspection, covenants with introspection. Like, you can inspect essentially what are the outputs, what are the inputs, and then you can make restrictions and say, hey, I want to have two outputs, and one should go there and the other should go there, and they should have this value or that value. And you can have very fine granular covenants, and that enables all kinds of interesting stateful contracts.
So in a sense, it's CTV, but at a little bit lower level, so that it's just kind of as broad as it gets from like a really fundamental building block in that way.
Yeah. And it can do all kinds of other cool things. For example, you can do Merkle path verification in a Bitcoin script. You can say, hey, show me an SPV proof that a particular transaction is included in the chain. Or you can do like another thing that I came up with is like a file hosting protocol, where you can, like, you have hosters that host files, and then you have people who want to download the files, for example, videos or something, and they have the file hash of the file of the video that they want to download, and then they want to pay a hoster to serve the file to them, and they want to pay them via Lightning, and they want to pay them in a trustless way, so that the hoster doesn't have to create any kind of like name for themselves or so. They just appear and say, hey, I'm a new hoster, and if you want files, I can sell them to you. And there's a protocol to facilitate essentially an atomic swap of files against coins. So you can pay via Lightning, and you pay the files exactly if they are delivered to you, and the other person gets paid exactly if they deliver the right files to you. So it's like an atomic swap, but it's coins against files, not coins against coins. And yeah, that is another thing that is enabled by OpCat.
Interesting. That's crazy. What's the, in the last, you know, how old is this now that this was released? This was just like a few weeks ago, right? 2 or 3 weeks maybe.
Yeah.
What have y'all run into anything that you hadn't? So your focus or mindset was about zero knowledge proofs. Have you run into anything that you hadn't thought of that somebody else brought up that you were like, well, that is a weird and fascinating idea for something that you could do with BitVM?
Yeah, it wasn't that clear to me that it's so easy to build like a RISC-V or so processor, because that makes it very, very feasible to compile high-level programs to just that thing. I thought at the beginning you would have more, I thought it should be more specific, or it would have to be more specific, that you have some kind of high-level language that then compiles down to Bitcoin script or something. And I thought it would need to be more complicated. But then when I talked more to people, this VM idea became very clear, and how to build that very efficiently. And now I think even you don't have to exchange much of a circuit in the beginning. In the beginning, I thought like you would have like 10 gigabyte or something of off-chain data that you have to send to each other upfront during setup. But I think even that is not necessary. I think you get away with like 10 megabyte or something for billions of state transitions. Like it's quite crazy.
Wow. So you can do it. So basically just in the last few weeks, you've realized that one of the major data limitations might not, basically a different way of thinking about it, you've been able to compress and or offload a lot of that cost, even in basically proving that everyone is on the up and up and everybody has the rightful ownership with this program or whatever that has been built into this script. Interesting.
You can always like pile these tricks on top of each other in an interesting way. Like it's so interesting that it's so much easier to disprove an incorrect execution than to actually execute it. And there's always new ideas to figure out how to disprove something more efficiently. And that's very interesting that optimization becomes better the more we think about it. Like vastly better.
6 months to a year of tinkering with this thing is going to be fascinating. And I'm really curious about Opcat too.
One thing that was something that I didn't expect yesterday, a guy named JC Crown, who I think you're familiar with. I think he's part of the Rally Bitcoin meetup.
JC,
He came into our Telegram group and he said, let's make a demo scene with this. And I've never heard of demo scenes before, so I had to look them up and find out what they are. And they're this like art format where you try to make a really cool visual or an animated video with audio in like less than 4,000 kilobytes of code. And so he taught me what demo scenes are, and he wants to make one in BitVM, which is really cool. Someone wants to use it for art already.
That's awesome.
And this would be way better than NFTs and stuff because none of it goes on the blockchain, which is great. Keep that all off chain, you know?
Hell yeah. That's awesome. Man, this is crazy.
Another cool thing is that we might do like cold golf tournaments. Like there are particular low-level instructions that we need. For example, XOR for U32, like for 32-bit XOR, essentially. And then we will make a cold golf tournament for people to compete who can do the implementation with the least opcodes. And then the winner gets like, I don't know, 100,000 or a million satoshis or something.
and a competition of implementing this efficiently.
Yeah, in Bitcoin script.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Like who needs the fewest opcodes to implement XOR or like whatever we need.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll actually get simplicity at some point?
I don't know.
I'll tell you this. Christian Liu is one of the guys who works at Blockstream, and he wrote a paper once about how to build simplicity from logic gates. And so he contacted me pretty shortly after this thing was started, and he was like, hey, I actually know how to build simplicity using logic gates, and you got a way to get any logic gate circuit to run on Bitcoin. How about we work together? So that sounds great. Maybe simplicity will launch on Bitcoin before it launches on Liquid.
Oh, wow. That's crazy to think about. Oh, well, shit. Okay. Well, I know, Robin, you said you had a call coming up, so I don't want to take any more of your time. Is there anything else you want to add or things that you're thinking about and kind of next steps with this? I'm going to be keeping an extremely close eye on this because this is fascinating to me. So what are next steps? What are you thinking about for BitVM here in the near to midterm future?
Yeah, the near-term goal is to finish this week a very simple version of that toy VM that I mentioned. So like with a very simple instruction set, and then then you can already disprove the entire thing on chain and like have this bisection game where you do the binary search over the states of the VM, and then like you find the state that is incorrect, and then you disprove it and stuff. And I think within this week we should definitely have a version that does that. And I think that will be very important for other people to really get what I'm talking about, because I confused a lot of people with the paper because it was more like making a theoretical point and like not really, it's not how it's a good idea from an engineering point of view. And I think it's important for people to get the idea of that VM and how to really, binary search a billion state transitions and stuff like that to really see the potential of that thing and like what it is capable of and where it could go.
Just be careful when you're writing white papers and you say something like, this is the naively you could do it this way, or this is the stupid way to do it. That's always music to my ears, because if it's stupid and naive, then I can probably manage to build
business
it.
All over it.
So yeah, so y'all do it. If you put in a stupid way to do it, I'm going to do it, and then we'll at least have a stupid version out there. So be aware of that.
Oh yeah. All right, dude. Guys, thank you. And is there any particular way? What's the best place for people to stay up on this? Is it join the Telegram group? Follow on Twitter. What you got? Give me, for the people who are interested in this and want to stay up on what you guys are doing, where do they go? So Robin, we'll start with you.
You can just follow me on Twitter, Robin_Linus, or just go to our Telegram group, which is, I think, bitvm_chat. And you can find my other stuff on robinlinus.com. Just one word, Robin Linus.
Oh, yeah. Testnet?
For me, you could follow me on Twitter. I'm super_testnet. But I definitely recommend you check out my GitHub. That's the best place to see what I'm working on lately. So go to github.com/supertestnet, all one word, no underscore on GitHub. And if you want to find me on Noster, that's also a great place to reach out to me. So you can find me on there by just searching for supertestnet in your favorite Noster client, and I'll probably show up.
Hell yeah. All right. I will have
two words on Noster.
Yeah. I will have links and pub keys and all that good stuff in the show notes. So hopefully everybody can just like look in the description and click and go check all this stuff out. And I'm definitely going to want that Telegram group chat so that I have another ridiculous Telegram chat to keep up on that blasts my notifications even larger than they already are. Guys, thank you again. Stay just a little bit again, just to make sure that this thing uploads. I do not want to lose this conversation. And thank you guys for joining me on Bitcoin Audible.